Namaste. In contrast to Harvard's discussions on India, you will see a completely different posture that Harvard maintains on China. Often Harvard is seen praising China for its accomplishments. Harvard, which is ostensibly the torchbearer of human rights the world over, looks the other way when it comes to China. Let's talk about Tibet. Have you noticed that the Tibetan freedom struggle has fallen out of favor in the West and no one is willing to champion the cause of the Dalai Lama, not in the least Harvard? American universities clearly understand the consequences of stepping on Chinese toes. For example, when the University of California at San Diego invited the Dalai Lama to its campus, it provoked the CCP. Many Chinese students on campus were organized to support the CCP's stance on Tibet and protest the Dalai Lama's visit. An article titled, "Is China Punishing a US University for Hosting the Dalai Lama?" explains the repercussions the university faced as China froze visas to its visiting scholars, among other measures. This was a way to send a clear message not to interfere with what China considers its internal affairs. Harvard has stored this line meticulously. Harvard's Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies has held a series of conferences on Tibet over the past two decades that play along with Chinese interests but yielded no tangible benefit to the Tibetans. Tibetan speakers were contained by the design of these forums in terms of format, framing of issues, and moderation. On the other hand, these forums presented the official Chinese government posture with no remorse or shame for all of China's human rights abuses. For instance, one of the speakers was Zhu Xiaoming, head of the Religion Bureau at the United Front Work Department in Beijing, which is responsible for internally managing China's Tibet policy. His position was, quote, "I think the negotiation should mainly discuss such questions as how the Dalai Lama and his followers should give up their stand for independence, stop carrying out separatist activities, and contribute to the reunification of the motherland and national unity and progress, but not the question related to the legal and political status of Tibet. Tibet is an inalienable part of China. What questions does the US Congress want the Chinese government to negotiate with the Dalai Lama?" he asks. "The status of Tibet, a high-level autonomy, or other questions? All these questions are not negotiable." Zhu Xiaoming has gone as far as to claim that under Chinese rule, Tibet was a model of progress and human development that was never seen even under Tibetan self-rule. In other words, China's occupation of Tibet was for Tibet's own benefit. There were no discussions on the many human rights abuses by the Han Chinese in Tibet and the annihilation of Tibetan culture. Of course, Harvard has never tried to construct subaltern identities within China or study the human rights abuses against its women and minorities the way that it has done in the case of India. Nor has it been necessary to blame the Chinese culture or civilization for these transgressions, the way all wrongs in India are somehow traced back to its ancient culture. The plight of Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps is another subject that seldom gets visibility in the Ivy halls of Harvard. What's worse, the Harvard Kennedy School has the notoriety of training two CCP officials that oversee the concentration camps for Uyghur Muslims. The Harvard Kennedy School graduates built or expanded 9 detention centers since 2017, stated a report in the Financial Times. Harvard's Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation claims that in its training and fellowship programs for Chinese participants, candidates are accepted only after being vetted by the US Embassy in Beijing. Yet, those Chinese officials with serious records of violating human rights somehow slip past this vetting, even though the US government has openly accused Beijing of turning Xinjiang into an open-air prison. The Ash Center flaunted its relationship with the two Chinese fellows in its program, stating that they were among the New World Fellows it has selected. In an interesting twist of fate and irony, Erkin Tunyas of China, whom Harvard trained to bridge the US-China relationship, was later put on the US Department of Treasury Specially Designated Nationals list, or the SDN list. The SDN is a blacklist maintained by the US under the Office of Foreign Assets Control. SDN assets are blocked and US persons are generally prohibited from dealing with them. Tunyas's assets are now frozen in the US and every American institution, including Harvard, is banned from dealing with with him. Harvard did not as much as issue a statement to distance itself from such Harvard fellows for fear of upsetting the Chinese. This contrasts with the way Harvard scholars in numerous programs and events routinely focus on attacking India. The most favored topics on India at Harvard include criticizing the Citizenship Amendment Act of 2019, the removal of Article 370 on Kashmir, Hindu chauvinism, caste abuses, women's abuses, mistreatment of Muslims, and so forth. Harvard blacklisted Shri Narendra Modi before he became India's Prime Minister and continues to slam him personally as well as his party, the BJP, for every imaginable kind of human rights violation, even when he has been cleared by the Indian courts. Another hypocrisy is Harvard's claim to champion free speech, an argument it used to terminate Indian economics professor Subramaniam Swamy. Harvard's complaint against him was over his statement that India's Muslims had Hindu ancestors. This should have been debated at Harvard to nurture free thinking among its students. After all, Indian Muslims do not prefer calling their ancestors foreign invaders from the Middle East. Hence, who else could have been their ancestors if not the natives of India, i.e. the Hindus? We do not endorse Harvard's capitulation to China, but are pointing out that India needs to learn how the game is played. A middle road needs to be found that balances protection of self-interest and academic freedom. Other hypocrisies of Harvard with respect to turning a blind eye on China include Harvard's lack of concern about China's efforts to deracinate the ethnic Mongolians in China's north, who protest the changes to school curricula that removes the Mongolian language. There are no protests or discussions on the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. Neither is the Taiwanese independence a hot topic at Harvard. Of course, you don't see Harvard issue major statements or organize conferences when dissident Chinese citizens suddenly disappear. Harvard lectures India on the Western ways of philanthropy, but where China is concerned, it is the other way around. The Harvard Kennedy School China Philanthropy Project pursues research on precedents and models of philanthropic giving by using models which have, according to the Kennedy School, ideological, institutional, social, and political similarities to China, but have remained understudied. The Kennedy School program studies ex-communist and socialist countries like Russia and the ones in Eastern Europe to study solutions that fit the CCP's ethos and vision. According to the U.S. Department of Education, Harvard is one of the top three American universities accepting Chinese funds since 2013. Harvard, in fact, is in lockstep with the CCP. It helps China on training CCP fellows that run Uyghur detention camps. It helps China build the social credit system that invades the privacy and rights of a billion people. Harvard takes on projects to sort out China's environmental logistics and infrastructure problems, all while being in alignment with the propaganda of the CCP. Frankly, we were not surprised to find that China occupies a much stronger position than India at Harvard, but we discovered something far more worrisome. China's inroads into Harvard are also a gateway for it to penetrate India with influence and subversion.